So welcome everyone to a new season of the show, season 5. This season, as always, will feature guests with a wide range of backgrounds related to food. Some will be new to the show, some will be coming back to visit us again, but always we and they will have a shared focus on the important goal of fostering and facilitating food sovereignty, helping to reestablish a food system in the Shuswap, which serves the needs of its citizens and provides them with not just sustenance, but with food that they want to eat, that is healthy, and that gives them food choices that they personally would accept. In short, it gives us food sovereignty. Now, I would point out that food sovereignty in the Shuswap is the same everywhere in the world, and my first guest of the season probably knows more about food sovereignty than anyone in this country and possibly around the world, and she's been around the world, too. Giselle Yasmin comes to us with the imposing title of Senior Fellow at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia. She's also an affiliate of the Margaret A. Gilliam Institute for Global Food Security at McGill University on the other side of the continent. Her CV of appointments and accomplishments, and this is just her abbreviated CV, is 2 pages of single-spaced fine print covering work all over the world, exploring and implementing ways to ensure everyone has enough food and healthy food to eat. Now, you might think that an academic with appointments at 2 universities would be stuffy and prosaic, but that couldn't be farther from the truth. Giselle is down-to-earth, articulate, animated, has a terrific sense of humor, as well as knowing a heck of a lot about food and food systems. She's had a 30-year career learning and practicing ways to conceptualize those systems, research them in detail, set them up, and make them work for the long term. We're all in for a real treat today, and so welcome, Giselle.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Delighted to have you here. And by the way, Giselle is fluent in French and English and knowledgeable of Urdu, Thai, Spanish, and Mandarin. So I think it's fair to say we could probably conduct this interview on just about every continent in the globe.
Not quite, but thank you.
Now, one thing that struck me as I was reciting this was that you're described as a fellow. Now, the word fellow has sort of got this masculine overtone, and yet it's still used widely in academic circles. And I thought it was kind of an interesting term, just as kind of a throwback to the times when, yes, men were in charge of everything and we knew everything and nobody else needed to do anything because we were managing it. Do you ever think about that? I mean, it's a throwback way back to far beyond where we are today.
It is. I'm glad you're not focusing on the senior part, though, because that could be, that could take us down the wrong path. But
that just means they pay you more money.
Yes, or no money. But no, I mean, really, it's an opportunity for me to hang my hat, at my old institute and be able to kind of do the work that I enjoy the most. And the title really does not really mean much. I'm a rogue academic who's actually worked on the cusp of the academic, public, and not-for-profit sectors my whole career.
You're a researcher for hire, and a lot of places need you, as it turns out. In fact, I heard you first speaking on The Current with Matt Galloway, and it was a piece about food banks, and Matt was focusing on the local and the national, and you kept on repeatedly trying to broaden the scope of the conversation to make it international and global. And that's what struck me, the fact that you have this focus and this perspective that covers, you know, a wide, wide area. So you can do this famous act of acting locally but thinking globally, and it seems to come to you naturally. And we'll talk about why it comes naturally in a minute, but you called yourself when we were talking, you said, I'm a citizen of the world with a Canadian passport. And I think that's a really good description because it kind of covers the pattern that you've established over the years. Now, by the way, you also have a couple of connections with this tiny metropolis of Salmon Arm. First of all, talk about 1984, the House of Commons. What happened there?
Yes. Well, in 1984, I started my first year of university, and I had been recruited to serve as a page in the House of Commons for my first year. There was a special program, and it still exists, called the Page Program, House of Commons Page Program. And there is someone quite well known in your community, Louise Wallace, now Louise Wallace Richmond, who's, I believe, an elected counselor, who was also part of my batch. And so we go back to that time, and it was one of those formative experiences. We're actually still in touch. Mm. We just had a Zoom call on Sunday, I think, or last weekend. Unfortunately, Louise couldn't make it. But we had a reunion in 2019, and some of us have gone on to do all sorts of interesting things. And it's one of those, you know, early formative experiences that open up your consciousness.
I've heard many people say that being a page in the House of Commons tells you a heck of a lot more about our political system than you would learn if you were coming through the elected representative pathway. You also have a connection with the sponsor of our show, Askew's Foods.
Well, yes. I mean, actually, I've been in the store. It's a wonderful store. Now, I haven't been there for a long time, probably 20 years.
It's still pretty good.
I've heard the store's been renovated, and there's all sorts of wonderful things happening. But as it turns out, my husband knows David Askew from his food business days. And also, Mr. Askew was on the board of an organization that I was the executive director of for 3 years, called Food Secure Canada. But I only learned that, I left that job about a year ago. But I only learned that near the end of my tenure, when I found an old database. And then one of the staff told me, oh, yes, you know, he was also on the board. And so it really is a small world, and it's a wonderful store. I love independent grocery.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yes. We'll, Giselle, we'll put you in the advertising material for Askew's Foods. If there were a couple of words to describe the pattern that's emerged over the years in your career, the words that I see coming up in your CV and in our conversation has been research and policy. Those two words seem to be sort of a defining mantra for much of what you've done. Is that a fair thing to say?
I would like to think leadership is also in the mix, because
absolutely.
I've had a number of leadership positions, building, leading teams, and either executive or managerial roles. So I enjoy that part of it as well. So trying to mobilize what do you do with that knowledge? You know, how do you put it to use? So that I think is another aspect of my career, but definitely connecting research and policy is one of them.
And what I sense you're saying is that it's not just researching and learning and developing policies, is actually making them work and putting them into action. And that's been what you're talking about there. Mm-hmm. Now, you have the kind of origin story that would lead anybody to become a bit of an internationalist. Your mother was French-Canadian, but with roots that go back to New England, which is not the entire experience of French-Canadians in this country. Just describe how that kind of worked.
Yeah, so Mom was born in Laval, Alberta. Actually published on this, and my maternal grandfather was born in New England, and actually there was quite a massive migration to the U.S. I mean, I think the population of Franco-Americans is like, I don't know, millions of people. Mm-hmm. and because I guess there were no, you know, people were suffering in parts of Quebec, so there were job opportunities as industrialization was happening. And so that's where my maternal grandfather was born. He was actually a naturalized Canadian, came as a teenager. At that time, he couldn't be a dual citizen. You had to choose. So, yes. And then my maternal grandmother was born in Western Quebec, not far from where I am now, in Ottawa, and moved when she was two. So, but what I discovered, okay, I don't want to digress, but we discovered, even just in the last 10, 15 years, was that there were people who migrated even from Argentina to, you know, Northern Alberta, and became
of course
part
Northern of Alberta, the goal for everybody.
so there were all sorts of, you know, people who went directly from Europe to Northern Alberta. So not everyone came from Quebec, but then there were also a number of people who came from the U.S. and some went back.
And your mother didn't do the conventional thing in the French Canadian community. She reached outside, way outside. the community when she met and then married your father. Your father's from India, from South India. It's an Urdu-speaking citizen of India. Was that something that, I mean, looking back, you can see that it must have put a little bit of internationalism into your genetic makeup in some fashion.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she was the only one from her immediate family to do so. Everyone else, you know, was dans la paroisse, you know, as they say, like
local
in the
parish. Yeah.
So mom was very adventurous, you know, I think from an early age. And, you know, she saw the world. And as I think I said on when we spoke earlier, just even marrying a Protestant would have been a huge deal. So to marry, you know, outside of Christianity and to, you know, that was considered quite a big deal at the time. But she saw the world, and then that also imprinted on me. And, you know, my father's was, both my parents have passed, from a multilingual family as well, and very much an internationalist. And so that, it does kind of rub off.
It's too late. You've got the bug, and it's going to be hard to get rid of it. I'm just going to mention to listeners that, or remind them, I'm speaking today to Giselle Yasmin, who is an esteemed Canadian and international policy and research expert and a leader in a number of organizations that have had an impact on food and food security and food sovereignty in this country. Your parents separated early and the peripatetic phase of your life began. Your mother was a nurse, an RN, and that was a ticket to travel, as it is for many sort of health professionals. And you ended up first moving west and then north and then sort of here, there, and everywhere. What was it like being a peripatetic daughter of an RN who was obviously everywhere she went was working busily. What was that like for you in terms of how it shaped your future?
Yeah, well, it was tough, to be honest. I mean, I think growing up in Western and Northern Canada in the 70s and 80s, when you're a mixed race person, you know,
you experienced racism.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Even though I'm considered relatively fair by, you know, depending on other, let's say,
when you're prejudiced, you look for trivialities.
Well, that's right. So, you know, I grew up being called the N-word, and, you know, it was sort of violent situations. But I mean, overall, I think I felt very privileged that I, you know, was from a family where I had access to education and basic health care and whatnot. But it was tough, and especially up north. Mm-hmm. Was a very militarized environment. There was a lot of racism. It was just reeking of colonialism. I'm sorry to use the blunt term. Mm-hmm. It was unapologetically, you know, that kind of environment at the time.
Now, despite living in we can't even say post-colonial world, a colonial imbued world, you had an experience towards the end of your high school time that really had a huge impact and set a certain direction for you. Why don't you describe what happened?
I mean, you know, you start discovering the world at age 16, 17, I somehow got invited to a meeting where the topic of global hunger came up. And
where was the meeting held, by the way?
It was held in Saskatoon, mm-hmm. Where I was finishing high school, and it was put on by the Hunger Project, which I believe still exists. And the core message was that world hunger was entirely preventable, and that we had the means to, you know, ensure that nobody on this planet went hungry, that it was not about too many people, not enough food. It wasn't about that, right? It was about equity, and it was about entitlements and distribution of wealth. And Amartya Sen had won the Nobel Prize around that time for his work on the Great Bengal Famine. So that was kind of life-changing. And I did a lot of public speaking and, you know, French-speaking contests and whatnot, and that became my theme. So it was one of those early experiences that kind of shaped me in terms of my interest in basic needs and food.
What was it telling you? What was it telling you that touched your heart? It was more than just an intellectual experience.
Well, it was telling me, it would make me angry, actually, because all I kept hearing was the propaganda that we're hearing less and less of now. It's starting to change, but that, oh my God, we need to produce more food. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it's a production issue. So it really, I think, anchored my thinking around this, and it's something I carried with me. And I think having been raised by a primarily single mother, I mean, yes, I did have contact with my father, but primarily it was on her shoulders.
For sure.
It made me sensitive to some of these issues of how people struggle, and then that's not necessary.
And it also plays in. It also plays into the colonial past that Eurocentric culture has had to deal with since then, because most of the food, especially in the last 50, 60 years, is produced in one part of the world where people are not always treated as well as they should, and brought to parts of the world where they're consumed probably in excess. I mean, it's very much part of the colonial structure that we've been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah, all those horrible ironies. And then, of course, Mom had worked closely with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples throughout her career as a nurse. And then when we went back up north, but also in Western Canada, I grew up kind of with a lot of First Nations, Métis, and even Inuit kids.
For sure.
And you saw the kind of impact, on how their systems, food systems, were kind of destroyed and the impacts of that. So I think there was a bit of sensitivity around that because I was able to observe certain things firsthand.
So not only did the Hunger Project message captivate you, but as you went through your formal academic training post-secondary, there was also an evolutionary process. 3 degrees, bachelor's degree in geography and political science, and by the way, you also crisscrossed the country. That seems to be in your genes. Then you got a master's degree in geography and housing. So you went from poli-sci, the systems that we humans develop, to the land. And then the further progression was when you did your PhD at UBC on this side of the continent, in geography and food systems. So there's sort of political structures, the land, and then the food that is grown on the land. Why don't you talk about that kind of progression? Because it's quite startling and fascinating.
Yeah, well, I think because I had applied to the Page program and, wanted to get in, you did the usual thing and said, oh, I want to do political science. And, developed a healthy cynicism, as one does.
Excellent.
In those early years. And thought, okay, Canadian politics is not the be-all and end-all. There's something more. So I changed to geography in my third year because I wanted that interface with the physical world as well, and something integrative, something systemic. And when I did my master's, it was on housing because I was very interested in, again, basic needs, cooperative housing, how do we have community solutions, the social economy, social and solidarity economy.
Yeah. So there's an element of social justice creeping in here as well, very much so.
Absolutely, and that's something that has framed, I think, my entire life. And then to do my PhD, because I had had these experiences as an undergrad, I finally had the opportunity to travel abroad besides the U.S., let's say.
Right.
And so I had been on a study tour to Thailand and I'd been on a study tour to India, and I really wanted to explore some of the themes, some of the differences that I had seen. And so I applied to UBC because the fellow, every time I expressed what I wanted to do, everyone said, you have to study with Terry McGee at UBC. You have to study with Terry McGee at UBC. So that's what I did.
So you obeyed the instruction.
Pardon me?
You obeyed the instruction.
I obeyed the instruction. He was the number one guy. It was a really good decision I made. I mean, I turned down Berkeley to study with Terry McGee at UBC. No regrets. His name opened so many doors. And he was also just such a guru. He's still alive. He's 88, I think, or 87 in Victoria now. And, he wrote the book on a lot of the, small-scale food enterprises and urbanization and all of the things that I'm interested in.
The one name that cropped up a couple of times in your comments, your CV, was Rosalind Kunin and Associates.
Oh, yes.
That's interesting. I of course, looked up Rosalind Kunin and Associates, and she's a quite esteemed sort of economist, business person, Order of Canada, multiple other honors as well. And she's a woman who's succeeded in an area where you know it's been male dominated for far too long. Yeah. What did that connection bring to you?
Yeah, well, Rosalind is one of my long time mentors, and she was the first woman to get her PhD in economics at UBC. And you know, she is just a very well known figure who, you know, takes complex topics and explains them. And so I was really fortunate to have her as a mentor, and, you know, we've done work together as well. I mean, she brought me on board some teams, and she's the type who, you know, she kind of throws you in the deep end and just say, okay, go for it. So, you know, you learn a lot from people like that. And
from near drowning experiences.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so we're very close to her and her husband, and, you know, we met her children, and, she's still going strong, you know.
It's interesting how we've had this obsession with youth in our culture. You know, mm-hmm. If you're young, you're going to be famous if you do something extraordinary, which is usually a bit bizarre. But what you're actually laying out is how experience and age and going around the block a few times gives you a perspective that is sine qua non, and we're growing back into recognizing that wisdom comes with the passage of time and lots of experience. I'm impressed by your relationship with 88-year-olds and, you know, other people. Your mom lived to 91. She died not long ago. That must have been a sea change for you.
Yeah, no, it was definitely. I mean, I think the loss of your parents is just one of these life-changing moments, a bit like when you become a parent yourself, if you have children. And certainly we expected mom to keep going, just like the queen, you know, Queen Elizabeth.
She's only 91.
Yeah, well, I think I agree with you, the whole respect for elders. And I was just saying to another mentor who's 80, and I said, I used to remember being the youngest one everywhere. Now I'm one of the oldest everywhere. What happened?
So, I don't know. It's a mystery.
I embrace that. But our society does value youth, and youth are extremely important. But we have to also acknowledge and respect our elders. And we need that intergenerational work and connection.
Just remind listeners that I'm talking today with Giselle Yasmin, who is an esteemed Canadian and international policy maker, researcher, and a leader in a number of organizations and processes that have had a big influence on food and food security and sovereignty around the world. Well, your career took off after you acquired all these degrees. It's hard to refuse somebody who's got a couple of degrees, isn't it, these days? It's not a bad thing. It's a good gig to have in your pocket. Various places. Worked in the Yukon. The BC and Yukon Centre for Research and Information in Canada helped to set up an office there. What was it like? Was that your first sort of, let's set up this whole gig?
Yeah, that was a startup. That was a startup. So that office had been run out of Calgary because, you know, typical central Canadians, it's like, let's just lump all the West together. And eventually there, you know, was a movement to, no, let's invest resources, group BC and Yukon together and create a new office. So that was an exciting experience. I started with next to nothing, and we developed some very interesting programming and kind of tried to challenge, one of the themes was Canadian unity. And traditionally it had been around Francophones, Anglophones, which is important. But, you know, my colleague in Calgary and I had the audacity of saying, well, you know, maybe Indigenous peoples need to be part of this conversation. Okay, this was a long time ago.
Surprise, surprise.
And it was a little bit controversial, but then eventually, you know, people came around and there were all sorts of things that we did, on citizenship and public engagement, and that kind of thing. It was a very rewarding time.
And then a little while later, You work for Elections Canada. Now, tell me why you work for Elections Canada, because it's not to do with food. It's not to do with, well, it ended up being a major research program that you became engaged in. But okay, there must have been a little story in there about why.
Yeah, that petite histoire, as we say, is that I think we were saying before getting on air, is that we worked on citizen engagement, but also proportional representation, electoral systems. Is the system broken? Do we need to do something? And that the success of one of the events of that ilk that we organized kind of got the attention. I had invited the chief electoral officer, Jean-Pierre Kingsley, at the time, and I guess they were quite impressed. It went extremely well. And next thing I knew, I got a call from a headhunter for an opportunity of a lifetime in Ottawa. And so, was offered to me, decided to take it up. And again, it was a research-oriented mandate. Policy, research, parliamentary affairs, eventually communications got rolled into the mix. But it did serve me well down the line, because when I was executive director of Food Secure Canada, we ran two Eat, Think, Vote campaigns. And so that knowledge of elections and how they roll out federally was helpful in terms of that work. And I was able to see it from the other side. So it all kind of made sense in the end.
Sure. Well, that's often the way it is. You take a side branch, you head off on a side branch of the railroad and discover that there's an interesting community at the end of it. It was interesting what you were saying a moment ago, that BC and Yukon ended up being sort of lumped together. I've worked in both places, and I have a feeling people in the Yukon would be looking down their nose and say, those people down south, what do they know? And the people down south would say, Yukon? I've heard of it. We still have these geographical and other kinds of separations that we pursue. Now, the next, in your work with Elections Canada, you were also, there was a bit of an emphasis on, as you say, marginalized communities, reaching them, involving them. And that also happened in your next work, which was with the, and I'll say the whole name and then I'll say the acronym, and we'll know why we say the acronym, Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, fortuitously abbreviated to the SSHRC. There you were working on really research. But also, both there and in Elections Canada, there was an emphasis on Indigenous marginalized communities. That was something you built in. Was that something you built in, or was that something that was already there?
Well, I think in both cases it was already there, but where, because Mr. Kingsley, just to rewind to that, had, like my mother, worked at the Campbell Hospital in Edmonton. I don't know if you know, really? there were, quote, Indian hospitals, okay?
About that.
And so that had been a formative experience for him. And he, wanted to show, he actually translated the referendum question in 1992 into 16 Indigenous languages.
It's interesting how many congruences have come to light as we've been talking. And the fact that you and the head of sort of Elections Canada would have worked had a connection to a small hospital in Manitoba that served the Francophone community, and also there were hospitals, as you say, that served the Indigenous community. It must have just kept on coming up that there was this embedded injustice that just seemed to be at that time part of the landscape. Not the physical landscape, of course, but the sort of intellectual landscape in this country. As you've watched this unfold, we just divert for a second. As you've watched this unfold, and we've started to have the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we've started to understand and be appalled by what was done to Indigenous peoples all over the country. When you watch the evolution from separate Indian, as they were called, Indigenous hospitals, and you see major organizations starting to recognize that this is a fallacious distinction and that we need to get away from it and start, expanding our horizons. As you watch these institutions moving forward and you see the culture of our country moving forward, as a Canadian, an international citizen with a Canadian passport, how do you experience that transition? How does it touch you?
Well, we obviously we We have a long way to go, but the world is decolonizing, not just in Canada, but also around the world. So there is this trend to try to undo those injustices or recognize those injustices and kind of get to a better place. So in that sense, I mean, of course, we don't want to, you know, pretend like there isn't a lot more to do, but there is a kind of recognition. I just remember that, you know, you couldn't even talk about certain things when I was growing up. I mean, you couldn't even put it on the table. So in that sense, I feel more hopeful.
I once asked an Indigenous friend of mine here, Louis Thomas, who's an elder with the Shkwepmik community, what it's like when he hears land acknowledgements. And sometimes I said they sound a bit superficial. What do you? How does that feel to you? And he paused for a moment. He has this kind of whimsical kind of smile that comes over his face, and he said, "Well, it's better than nothing at all." And I mean, we need to go so much farther than what we're doing now. But the evolutionary process is well established there. Now, your next work was with the Food Secure Canada, a very well-known organization that works on the kinds of issues that we're talking about today. And in that sort of mix, by this time you'd already met your husband. And your husband, you described him as a very good-looking guy in a crowd, but it took a while for the two of you to kind of get to that point of where you said, okay, we're going to get married and that's final. But you and your husband, Ishkandar, have a very, I mean, spiritually and intellectually, you would appear to be very much on the same page. For one thing, he has a background in the Ismaili community, which is well known around the world for having values. I mean, values that involve compassion and doing good works. And then also is involved in the food business. For heaven's sakes, it was, as you said to me, it was a marriage made in the kitchen. Why don't you describe how that worked, you know, I mean, for both of you, obviously you brought something to each other. Very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually we've been married 23 years now. So plus 1 year of engagement, 1 year of courtship. So 25 years altogether.
Yes. Delicate process.
Yes, I feel like a statistic out there, a good one. But my in-laws were involved in the food business. My father, my late father-in-law, was a pioneer in a sense.
Indeed.
Both in Uganda and in Canada and in the food business, and came from a food family. You know, they owned one of the most famous bakeries in Kampala. So my husband was born into that world.
Indeed.
And in a sense, you know, that little coincidence with my husband then joining the business and getting involved in organic, natural, gourmet specialty, which is really his passion because he believes in the values. It's not because it's not just about making money. It's about, you know, yes, it has to be a viable business, but he actually believes in the values.
He ended up.
So that's one of the things that brought us together for sure.
And he ended up being the sort of manager, CEO of Choices Foods, which has 10 stores in British Columbia. And I found an article describing, the title is Ishkandar Ahmed is in a quandary. And the quandary was this. He had two stores that were equidistant and far enough away from the nearest liquor stores that he was able to get a liquor license. But he wasn't really interested in that all that much. And what actually happened was the article talked about the fact that he was being pressured. The large stores like Sobeys were doing things that Walmart has. They call it the Walmartization of the retail work. That is that you put pressure on your suppliers to sell you their products for less, and then you say if you don't, you won't get any business with us. And he was in a community and an environment, retail environment, where that was exactly what was going on. And Sobeys at that point had said they were going to force their suppliers to give them a 1% discount, retroactive discount, and not raise their prices in to other suppliers. So in other words, they were going to force them into this tighter fiscal situation just because they were big. And your husband was very, Iskander was very explicit about the fact he didn't want to do that. And he didn't want to grow choices to be a big, you know, have a big IPO, make tons of money and expand all over the world. I was very impressed to see that and thought that must be something that also must have drawn you to him. This sense of, you know, looking beyond just profit and loss and looking at the meaning of, you know, what selling things is. Yeah. Am I telling you something you didn't know about Iskander?
I didn't know about that article, actually, but I'll just look it up. But I know that, and of course, my husband was the CEO, not the owner, not the owners,
one of
the owners.
But, that's right.
But during COVID, I mean, because they had those local supply chains, and, you know, that was a huge plus.
Absolutely.
And so I know that that's very much part of the business model. But I think those, yeah, those values, I mean, how do you bring social justice and, you know, those kinds of values into the business world? And it is possible. So that's definitely been a factor that's kept us together.
And I think it is said that when relationships work, it's usually because values are shared. It's not because you like playing tennis together or you like going skiing or you like reading novels. It's because they're shared values. And also you amuse each other. I think that's, do you guys amuse each other?
We do. We have a lot of fun together. Yeah.
Well, the future is bright. The next area that you worked in was Food Secure Canada. And that's something that you were involved with until the beginning of last year. What was that world like for you that you got into when you joined into Food Secure Canada?
Well, you know, it was really exciting because the food policy for Canada was about to be launched, and that was a very exciting time. But on the other hand, there was also some that challenge around there had been a boycott or walkout by Black Indigenous people of color at the November 2018 assembly before I joined. So we had to kind of balance those two things. We had to kind of build the team, rebuild some trust. And so it was exciting, but there were also some challenges, but I think we, you know, we worked well. I mean, there was cooperation with all sorts of partners and board and staff, you know, really got to a much stronger place, also financially and whatnot. And in my earlier position at when I was 7 years at SHRC, as you mentioned, I mean, I had seen the growth of the food movement and the scholarship around food studies. You know, I think it was in 2007, the Canadian Association of Food Studies had been created. And I thought, wow, that's a milestone.
We're getting somewhere.
So there were, you know, there were a lot of different dimensions to all of this. And of course, I did a number of things in between those two positions.
Yes, the fine print on your CV is littered with all sorts of little bits of things here, consulting for this group, organization, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, being busy is not something you have had to worry about over the years. I just should mention a previous guest in our show who coordinates the school food system in British Columbia, got her inspiration from going to an annual general meeting of Food Secure Canada and came away with, like you came away as a teenager from learning about the Hunger Project, came away inspired and really shaped in terms of her future work. So I think Food Secure Canada, just the title alone gives a kind of an indication of something that's really important pretty much to everyone on the planet. But obviously in this country, big geography, lots of spaces far apart, it's also important as well.
But you know, Warren, in French, there's a nickname that's used, which is very different. It's le Réseau pour une Alimentation Durable, Network for Sustainable Food Systems.
Indeed.
That's the name of French. Yeah.
Indeed, which in a way, durable in French is somewhat better term. It means it's tough and it can handle whatever comes at it. I'd like to spend the rest of our time today picking your brain a little bit about some key concepts that I think listeners here in a small community of 17,000 are very much aware of. We're very aware of concepts like food security. But from your kind of international perspective, let's do a little definition finding. How would you define food security?
Well, there's the classic, you know, FAO definition and the World Commission on Food Security, you know, all people at all times have access to culturally acceptable, the normal definition that's been used. And I think you've also spoken about food sovereignty, and I've had the privilege of collaborating over the years long before, you know, as far back as, I don't know, the mid 2000s, around the time when that concept was coming up of food sovereignty in La Via Campesina, and which has that element of control, right, of that people have the right to define and control their own food system. So it really takes it a step further. And I've worked, my work was on foodscapes. And so that...
It's a concept that you developed.
Well, that I know I was the first to publish on it. That has been validated recently, but there has been more and more work on, you know, how do you view society through the lens of food? And you can approach that from various perspectives. And a lot of the work has been either public health or environmental. I mean, there are a lot of different dimensions at play. So, I mean, all of these concepts are useful in different ways.
So how would you see food sovereignty, food security expressed or not expressed in this country?
You know, these things are a constant struggle and negotiation and a meeting of minds, you know. So, you know, you've got the federal government working towards something now, and you know, activists had a huge part in making that happen, Food Policy for Canada. You've got initiatives at the provincial level, you've got municipal level, you've got Indigenous-led governments. I mean, you there are so many different layers to this. You've got citizens' action, people power. You've got the academic perspective, which often works in collaboration with community. You've got the business world as well, where I would also include the alternative, you know, business world. BC has been just such a leader in that area.
BC is quite interesting. Yeah. BC and Quebec. Quebec has also
BC
been a
and
leader.
Quebec, those are always the provinces which have so much innovation on this front. And so I think it's hard. You've got school food activists. I mean, you know, you've got so many layers. I think it's a patchwork. And one of the challenges is, you know, having that common, developing some kind of common vision or something, a few things that people can agree on to move forward. So I think the school food, you know, that is moving forward. I mean, in very exciting ways. Does it need to be done right? Yes, of course. Are there risks? Of course. But, you know, it's moving. It's moving in an interesting direction. So those are, I think, some examples. The Indigenous food sovereignty work, really exciting work that's happening. There's a Black food sovereignty movement, but there's also, you know, universities. I think as you know, I'm about to take a new job in university. There are all sorts of alternative foodscapes developing within universities all over the country and colleges. So that's a very exciting phenomenon.
So let's bring this right back to a particularity. Tell me something about an experience you had with haggis.
Oh God, haggis. Yes. Well, I've only had haggis once in my life. And I had it at a Burns dinner, but it was not exactly a traditional Burns dinner. It was called Gung Haggis Fat Choi, Robbie Burns Day, Chinese New Year, Dragon Boat Dinner. And it's something that started in Vancouver years ago by a fellow named Todd Wong, who actually had some First Nations cousins too, but he was a Chinese Canadian who...
He was covering all his bases.
Well, he was in the pipe band. You know, there's a pipe band at SFU.
Yes, indeed. And quite famous.
He was the fellow who, you know, whatever, the you know, walks at the front and keeps
the
time. Oh,
yeah, the sergeant major, drum major, yes.
He loved it so much. So he started this, and that, even though I have all these friends of Scottish background, you'd think I'd been would have been invited to a, you know, traditional
American meal. Meal. Yes.
Never happened. But so I went to that dinner, and that was the only time I ever had haggis, and it was covered, slathered with sweet and sour sauce. And here we are coming up to Lunar New Year, Chinese New Year, on starting on Sunday, Year of the Rabbit. We've got Burns Day on the 25th. Apparently, it was extended to Seattle, but I don't know if these things are still happening. But it was a load of fun.
So do you have a yen to go to another Robbie Burns banquet and eat slathered haggis?
I'm not going to make it anywhere this next Wednesday, but I'd love to try. I know there's a number of things happening here in Ottawa, but I won't be able to partake, unfortunately. But yeah, I would love for the Gung Haggis tradition to continue.
Giselle, is this not a little bit of a sign of the times? Is this not telling you and me and the rest of the world something about how, instead of cultures being sources of division, they're really something that can make the world a much more exciting place when they come together and they collaborate?
You know, absolutely. And I think that was what Todd went by, Toddish McWong sometimes. I don't know what happened.
His intent was
bring some fun into it.
Yes.
And, you know, cross-cultural experience, everyone had a blast. And so, you know, I really value those kinds of experiences.
I want to talk a little bit about something that obviously is dear to your heart, and that is the role that women are playing in everything from policy development and research, which is where you've shone, but also in terms of the nuts and bolts of growing food. It's not that women haven't played an important role, but in countries like Canada, that hasn't always been the case. It's often been a male-dominated world, but it's changing quite quickly. And again, BC and Quebec are the provinces where women, especially young women, have really taken on the task of growing food, working in organizations that promote food. You're a woman yourself. I can't speak about this, but you can say something that will be germane. What is your sense of what's happening there?
Yeah, well, I think there's a bit of a revisionist history happening too, because women, a lot of small food producers in the world are women. And usually there's a division of labor, which isn't necessarily visible. So, for example, in Southeast Asia, women will tend to and transplant seedlings, you know, in the rice paddies and whatnot. And then, of course, the food preparation, transformation. There are also other patterns, you know, cooking meat outdoors tends to be a male thing worldwide. That's a thing.
They have aprons
to prove it. Patterns. There are patterns. So, you know, I think that women are also sick of being a little too, you know, connected to, especially having the pressure of having to prepare food for your family and you know, all of that work as well. So there's that labor piece,
right?
Unpaid labor. So there are a number of dimensions, but certainly women are at the forefront of wanting to transform the food system, and I think have that deep interest in nutrition and, you know, really from a very community-minded way. So there's some extremely exciting things happening.
There in this part of the world, in the Shuswap, where we're broadcasting from, I would say a preponderance of farmers that I've interviewed on the show have been women and a young women. And they're often the driving force in terms of bringing new values into the food world. They want to move beyond just growing food as a mechanical operation or as a biological process into integrating food into the community as an element that fosters the things we've been talking about earlier, things like social justice and inclusivity. What did you comment on that?
Yeah, it reminds me of a statistic I heard when I was, you know, as you mentioned, Vice President of Research and Partnerships at SHRC. I learned that women were more interested in the health sciences too, and life sciences. So connection to, you know, how do we connect all living things and you know, what is our place? How does that relate to nutrition and the one health, you know, human, environmental, animal health? the microbiome, all of these issues. So I think that's where I don't know if I can, respond at length, but that's where I see there's a definite interest on the part of women in some of that work.
It's interesting you mentioned the microbiome. The humans, of course, and all living creatures have a microbiome of some sort. And when it first developed, well, it first patented glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, they also patented it as an antimicrobial, as an antibiotic. We call them antibiotics, but they're antimicrobials in the form of antibacterial and also in the form of antifungal. And the only reason they didn't put it on the market was because human health is monitored a little more closely than plant health. You can introduce an agrochemical and get away with it doing some nasty things to other non-target species, but you can't do that with humans. If you're giving somebody who's diabetic a drug that also makes them lose their eyesight, for example, then it probably won't last very long. We're just closing in the end of the show. I would like you to kind of sit back. I think the term in the House of Commons would be blue skying, just kind of reflecting on what you've seen in your 3-decade career, looking at policies, making policies, leading initiatives. How would you characterize what you see going on in the world these days in this area of food and its associated phenomena?
Yeah, well, despite all the troubles in the world, I mean, I do have hope that you can't control information and knowledge the way you used to. I mean, your show is kind of a living example. We're at this confluence of COVID, climate, conflict, but as you rightly wrote, I saw your piece in the National Observer. People are seeing through this rhetoric of, oh, is this just a virus in search of a vaccine? I mean, no, it's not that simple. We have all of these living systems are related. These zoonotic diseases has to, what
Indeed.
is our relationship to the earth and to each other, to other species? We're not that separate, right? We're all kind of interconnected. We have all of these things in and around our bodies, and so the health of our planet, health of our species, the survival of our species and other species, we have to act now. It's no longer negotiable. Even McKinsey
Yes.
is talking about how the costs of the global food system in terms of health, environment, and whatnot outweigh the values, it outweighs the outstrips the value it
The
used to.
benefits, yes, indeed.
None of it. So even McKinsey, I mean, so I never thought I'd see that. And now, of course, they may have different solutions, but okay. But at least if we can agree on what's the problem we're trying to fix, that is a good step. And so I do have hope. And there are things happening on the ground all over Canada, all around the world, that and the youth are really an inspiration.
There was a survey regarding climate change recently in 10 countries, sorry, 12 countries, 10,000 young people between the ages of about, oh, 12 and 20. And they were asked for what they thought was going on in the world. And they talked about a sense of a moral failure in leadership. It seems to me that what you're talking about is regenerating or reinserting
Yeah.
a sense of moral responsibility into the way we, anybody who's involved in a leadership role, should be functioning.
Yeah, absolutely. We all have a role to play. And we all, it's not on the shoulders of one person. It's collective and the power is out there.
Not on
Right?
the shoulders of one person or even one generation. We're now at the end of the show, and I really want to thank you, Giselle, for an inspiring conversation that has really touched in a lot of issues that, while they are to some degree international and global, they also are reflected at the local level and very much reflected in this community where I live and in the communities that you live. And there's a lot more of those than there are of mine, but your perspective has really, I think, enhanced what we're trying to think about in this community. And I'm sure many listeners will resonate with pretty much everything you've said today. So I thank you very much for being with us. And perhaps at some point we may hunt you down and ask you for some, your thoughts and opinions on other matters related to food. Thank you very much once again.
Thank you very much, Warren, for having me, and greetings to all friends in the Shoe Swap.